We're still short of a quorum, but I'll call the meeting for government operations to order for this morning. And members, just a heads up, and I'll give you a chance to look at it, the minority members. We do have a 24-hour rule in this hearing. House filed 1943. There's an amendment that came in late, and we put it in the packet for you guys to look at it. House filed 1943. And I want to try and make sure we keep on the 24-hour rule because we have a lot of work to do this year, so we want to get through it. But I guess for the minority members, give me a heads up on whether you'd be willing to hear it, let that amendment be heard. We can decide when the bill comes up. Representative Pepper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at it now, and I think that it seems like it's a little bit more than just a sentence or two. It seems like there could be some implications that we'd like further time to consider.
And the bill does have another stop before we leave. We'll get to the floor, so there's an ability for them to put it on elsewhere.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be my preference.
Okay, then we will not hear the amendment on 1943, just debate the bill as it was introduced. Thank you. Hanson's here. Do we have a quorum now? We have a quorum now. Representative Hanson showed up from rules. First thing I'll do is Representative Freiberg, have you read the minutes from the last meeting?
Yes, I'll move approval.
Motion is to approve the minutes from the meeting of March. What was the date, March?
February 26th.
February 26th, thank you. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is approved. Now, House File 1984, Representative Sundin. Welcome to our committee, and I'll move House File 1984 to be recommended to be referred to Commerce, Consumer Protection. Is that the right one? Commerce, Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Jobs.
What's that?
Is it jobs? Excuse me.
No.
It goes to Commerce first, then it goes to jobs.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Dean, welcome to the committee, and please begin your testimony. Explain your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. 1984 deals with responsible bidding practices here in the state of Minnesota. When state money is expended, we expect a good return for the dollar, and the contractors and vendors that actually perform the work or provide services should be held responsible and held to high standards. And we expect that good return on our money. We got a number of testifiers today that can outline some of the needs, some of the situations that have come about necessitate this legislation moving forward. And we've got building trade representatives that have extensive experience enforcing some of the rules that contractors are required to abide by. And I'd like to bring up Mike Wild of the Fair Contracting Foundation. He can explain his role in this.
And Representative Sundin, I see you have a DE1 amendment that did make the 24-hour notice. Do you want me to put it on first?
Yes, please.
I'll move the DE1 amendment for House File 1984 to put it at the bill in the fashion that the author wants. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Motion is approved. Amendment is adopted. Mr. Wild, please welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony. And members, because we have a full agenda today, if you can keep it as succinct as possible, 2.5-3 minutes would be great. We have a lot of stuff to do today, and we're short because the session went a little longer than expected.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Mike Wild. I'm the executive director of the Fair Contracting Foundation. In 2007, the recession was devastating to the construction industry. Unlawful employment practices became rampant in construction, both nationwide and in Minnesota. In 2010, the industry was at its lowest point in a generation. The Minnesota Building and Construction Trade Council in 2011 created the Fair Contracting Foundation. Within 2 years, the FCF was adopted and funded by hundreds of Minnesota construction contractors and adopted through 9 contractor associations. It's now a labor management cooperative committee formed under the Federal Labor Management Cooperation Act of 1978. We advocate for practices, policies, and laws that ensure fair government contracts, a strong local industry, and the protection of public interest. And that's what I'd like to talk about today, the protection of public interest. I want to give you a few examples of the cases that have been investigated and found violation, for which violations have been found by state agencies. Number one, in 2012, a large Minnesota State College University construction project at the North Hennepin Community College produced documented evidence of wage violations that were shared with our Department of Labor and Industry. At that time, the Department of Labor found 4 contractors had wage violations on that state project totaling $23,000. Number two, one of the subcontractors on that particular project was the prime focus of a federal wage and hour investigation on a federally funded project in Woodbury, Minnesota, the year before. That subcontractor was responsible for a majority of the $370,000 of federal wage violations on that project. Number three, on that same project, beyond the 4 subcontractors that I've spoken of, there was a 5th contractor. Our attorney general had to initiate action against this vendor hired by the state. The case was just recently resolved through our 2 agencies, the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Labor and Industry, after investigation and litigation recovering another $54,000 of underreporting and misclassification of workers, totaling $77,000 in vendor violations on just 1 college project. There have been dozens and dozens of projects, scores of projects, many of which are minuscule. This was just one. Cities have seen the same problem found on some of these minuscule projects. One FCF investigation led the city of St. Paul to recover $48,000 and initiate its first debarment in a decade. The case settled short of debarment, but the same contractor was found with identical violations on both DNR and Minnesota Historical Society projects. Our public schools might have even greater problems. One of the first cases we investigated found that an elementary school was being built in part by bricklayers who were paid cash under the table as though it was an underground economy project. When confronted, that particular subcontractor literally abandoned the project overnight. Another affluent Western Metro school district allowed their public funds to compensate a subcontractor whose owners had existing state and federal tax liens under a prior business name just months earlier. These are 6 samples of scores of cases that have been investigated and filed during 2 full calendar years. In the year 2011, the Department of Labor and Industry had its highest year of prevailing wage violation recoveries. That was 2011. In 2012, the department recorded a 270% increase in dollars recovered, and the number of cases actually doubled. The samples I've referenced are supported by public documents. They are objective findings, actual developments of serious contractor misconduct. But nothing prevents these contractors from being hired on our next public construction project. They're on the same footing as proven and responsible contractors who comply with the law and the public contract. The Fair Contracting Foundation appreciates the time and attention that you give to the standards that we should expect for responsible contractors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of the testifier? If not, thank you. And the next person I have on here is Brendan Cummins on my list. I see Mr. Melander coming to the... Are you going to be testifying for Brandon?
Yes, and I will.
Welcome to our committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Harry Melander. I work at the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council as their chair. Our community of builders is 55,000 and strong and growing partly because of the good work you've done in previous sessions, putting Minnesotans back to work, and we thank you for that. Today I'm here to comment on House File 1984, a bill we believe, as you should, that Minnesotans want businesses that use their money responsibly. And to make sure that businesses that play by the rules are given opportunities to prosper as private businesses using public dollars. We believe that this bill will assist contracting authorities and municipalities that do not exist in our current public bidding practices. Responsible contracting practices will provide contracting authorities and municipalities with a new tool that will support the type of businesses that we all value in Minnesota: fair, registered, insured, and those that have not had compliance issues with workers regarding compensation matters. Public dollars benefit our private business partners. We should want to make sure that those individuals that benefit from public dollars comply with laws that you created. Responsible Minnesotans, responsible contractors should not have an issue with this bill. Today you heard from an individual that gave detailed examples of why this bill is important to you and to those good Minnesotan businesses. This bill is not intended to create more work for our private partners or our contracting authorities or municipalities. It will ensure that that agencies that stated above, when awarded a project, will have subcontractors and contractors that what we call abide by the standard business value in Minnesota, compliance of all state laws and statutes described within this bill. And if their contractors have not complied with the law, these agencies will have the ability to address these issues prior to a project is mobilized or engaged. Today, I'm sure you will hear from individuals and groups that say this is more regulation, more paperwork, and will create less interest on public jobs, which will make a competitive disadvantage on publicly funded projects. Chair, members, all we are asking is that companies that use public monies say on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of white stock that they have not broken the law. That's it, nothing more. What it does for projects, those agencies, and for those that can't fill that out, we are saying, is it too much to ask? We think that businesses in Minnesota need to abide by the law. We think that this is a minimum requirement, and this is good public policy. If there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Any questions of the testifier? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Melander. And next I have Phil Raines. Oh, yeah, I missed that. And then Mr. Becker and Mr. Werke are next. Welcome to committee, Mr. Raines. Please state your name for the tape.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name's Phil Raines. I'm Vice President of Public Affairs for Associated Builders and Contractors. We are a statewide organization of commercial construction contractors who do a significant amount of the government's work right now. And in looking at this bill, we have significant problems with it. Mr. Melander just said that this bill just says people certify that they have not broken the law. What it actually does is it changes the burden of the law out there right now. Currently, there is a good statute, or it's actually in rules, allowing debarment for people. One of the testifiers before this said that they ran into some pretty egregious, willful, and repeated violations. Willful and repeated is a great phrase. It's what's currently in the rules saying you can be debarred for doing this. The reality is on these public projects, this is kind of like being audited by the IRS for the responsible contractors out there. If you get audited by the IRS, I pretty much guarantee you that they're going to find something that they're going to say, you didn't calculate this right, you should redo this way. It's not that you're not trying to comply with the law, you're doing the best you can under the circumstances. And you try to fill it out and you do an honest job, but you're pretty much going to get written up for a violation somewhere along the way. People willingly and voluntarily comply with this currently. Whenever there's an audit, people come in and say, well, this person should have been classified this way. A great example is one of our contractors working on a job had some hollow metal doors, and the contracting authority looked at them and said, no, no, you have carpenters classified as doing this. And said, no, it should be iron workers, which, you know, to most people in the trade, they tell you is a crazy, crazy prospect. Carpenters, I you know, had a discussion with the chair about this. He used to be a carpenter himself, and he knows a job where this kind of situation came on, and he, as a carpenter, had to go in and fix the job for the iron worker that was doing the work. But in most of these situations where they come, we get these allegations put against us, our contractors simply write a check. It means that the checks go out to the workers very quickly, and there's not a dispute. In this specific instance, we had a rare situation where a contractor said, dug in his heels and said, no, I'm not going to take it. He had about $117,000 liability put against him, went through the adjudication process, an ALJ, an administrative law judge sided very strongly with the contractor and said they were frankly being abused by the state in this process. And in the end, the department gave up the lawsuit because it was outrageous. The contractor involved spent over $300,000 fighting that lawsuit. Over $117,000 worth of wages, and he lost over $200,000 in the process. But he did it on principle. It's very rare that a contractor would actually do that because you make a business decision and you write the check out and go with it. Under this bill, as it's currently composed, under the DE amendment or what I understand of the next draft that's coming, the same would be true. The contractor would have to fight this. This is going to lead to increased costs for the department because contractors will have to fight all of these allegations going forward instead of just writing a check. This means that the workers actually get their checks slower, later than they would have before. And finally, this is going to mean that some very good contractors that are willing, that are trying their best to build a project, fill out the paperwork as they can, are going to be debarred under this. These are responsible contractors. I think you're going to hear from AGC as well, ABC and AGC between the two of us, take up nearly all the commercial contracting people in the state. We're both very worried about this bill, and I think we both represent the responsible contractors that are out there. We represent the established guys that do this stuff and do this stuff well. And we're very concerned about it. And in the end, as Mr. Melander noted, people are going to have to charge a premium. If this is out there, you're going to have to build this into your bid going forward and add a padding in there to make sure that you can't be thrown off a job somewhere in the future. Frankly, when I call my contractors, a lot of them right now tell me, I don't do public work anymore because of the burdens that come with that. It's just not worth my time. There's other work out there. This would increase that burden and, in fact, throw a lot of them off that want to do this work right now. I can tell you, from an association perspective, I counsel my guys right now. There are some vendors of the state that I actually tell the contractor, take your bid, increase it 20%. Over what you have already, because if you increase it 20%, you might break even on the project. And that's just ridiculous. In an uncession that we have coming forward right now, this is kind of the opposite of it. It's increasing the burdens, and it's going to actually lead to a shortage of people that are capable and willing to do work on state projects.
Thank you, Mr. Raines. Questions of the testifier? Mr. Raines, Representative Winkler, I have a question first, and you talk about just writing a check. So the question I have is, so these contractors who are violating, maybe knowingly violate, or maybe playing the game of, we'll see how many times they get caught, and I'll just write the check to take care of it, but continue those practices going forward. Is that what you're advocating that we permit on our state projects, or is it just do you have some other explanation for that?
As a matter of fact, absolutely not. These are people that have violated inadvertently along the way, and the department generally recognizes that when that comes forward. And when it is willful and repeated, as you were describing the person acting, that is grounds for debarment. And under the state's debarment procedure right now, I counted up 17 vendors that have been debarred by the state. I'm not here supporting those people in the least. I think they should be, but we already have a good standard of willful and repeated violations, and that would cover basically what the initial testifier has talked about, the willful and repeated violations.
Thank you.
It's a good standard.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Raines, I'm a little confused about the testimony and how the bill works. As I read the bill, essentially what the contractor has to do is certify that they've complied with the law and these the legal provisions specified here, specifically related to wage and hour issues, primarily. And it seems to me what the bill does is kind of is shift the risk to contractor to compliance, so that the contractor, in this most cases probably the general contractor, has to police the subs, has to police its own operations to make sure that workers are getting what they're supposed to get under the law. And as a principal matter, I don't know why that wouldn't be the right place to shift the risk, to put that on the people who want the business to make sure that they're complying with the law. I don't see anything in here about private right of action from employees being increased or more lawsuits or anything else. It just looks like to do the bid, you have to certify that you're going to comply or that you have complied. So are there details in here? Do you disagree with that principle, or are there some specific pieces in here that you have a problem with, or what's the nature of the objection?
Mr. Raines.
Chair Nelson, Representative Winkler. If you look on page 2, line 230, you'll see the operative phrase that starts to change this. For purposes of this subdivision, that's creating an entirely new standard out there.
Are we talking, Mr. Raines, are we talking the bill or the amendment?
I'm sorry, I'm looking at the bill. If you give me just a second, I will look at the amendment. You can look on line 3.5 for purposes of this clause. Whenever you see that phrase, you're writing new statute. You're writing a new standard, which is what this is. The contractor already carries, the general contractor specifically, already carries liability for all of the subcontractors' work under it right now, and can be brought up with a liability for everything that's done by a subcontractor under it. That's the current standard already. The operative phrase starts there. That's the start of the new standard.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Raines, but what you described, though, is kind of a reactive system, where if somebody discovers a problem, then you can react to it. The department can react to it. Presumably, the employees, if they have a right of action, can react to it. Whereas this seems to be taking a different approach, which is to say, a new standard, but it's saying, we're not just going to be reactive. You actually have to take the steps yourself to make sure that you're in compliance in order to bid the project. I grant you that's new, but why shouldn't that be the responsibility of the contractor? And I'm trying to get to is, do you just disagree that we should have more of a proactive front-end system, or is there details in here that you want to change?
There's Mr. Raines.
Chair Nelson, Representative Winkler. It is already the standard that you must certify everything that comes forward. This doesn't change that standard at all. When you sign on to a project, when you sign on to a contract, you already have to certify that you will be in compliance with prevailing wage. You already have to certify that your subs will be, and every 2 weeks you must fill out paperwork showing that you are all along the way. There is a standard that says you have to show that this has never happened in the past. And as I said, that is a different standard, in that people were, under the current system, are debarred for willful or repeated violations. So when someone is acting as a bad actor, they can be debarred. When someone makes an inadvertent error, they cannot be debarred. Again, this says, if you've ever made the error, you can be debarred going forward. That's a pretty high liability for guys going forward, because they're in the business of contracting and in the business of building things. They're in the business of paying their workers. This is an additional standard they come under for the state looking over their payroll record. And frankly, there are hiccups when you go along that.
Representative Winfrey.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Raines, my understanding then of your testimony is that it's what you're concerned about is getting tripped up on smaller violations that might not be material or something like that. They're small things that you can't, nobody's perfect, and you don't want to be held to a standard of perfection or risk not ever getting a contract again. And it looks like there are some things in the bill that create some standard or a threshold, but it sounds like, from your perspective, if you dealt with some of the kind of inadvertent mistake risk that this bill might entail, that your concern would be alleviated.
Absolutely.
And Mr. Raines.
Sorry, Chair and Representative Winkler. Absolutely. We're concerned about the inadvertent mistakes, and the problem is when you have a crew of carpenters get reclassified as iron workers, that number can get big really quickly. When you're doing a $1 billion stadium, $10,000 or $25,000 is rounding error, literally rounding error. And people can get tossed off very quickly, including the bigger you are, the bigger your liability that comes under this.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Raines. So somewhere between willful and repeated and one $10,000 mistake?
Exactly.
Mr. Raines, on that $10,000, if that was, and I understand that in some big projects that could be a rounding error, if that was instead of a set dollar amount, if that was a percentage of the project, would that be more, something more in line with what you would be able to accept, or are you just like the whole bill, hate the whole bill as a whole?
Looking at a percentage is moving in a positive direction, I would say. I wouldn't say I would sign off on that, because, as I said, you have situations where you have carpenters redefined as an iron worker. That can be a significant portion of your job that goes there. I really appreciate the current standard that's out there of willful and repeated, because it goes to the motivation, goes to the actions of the work of the contractor in this situation. Are they looking to cheat the system? And if they're looking to cheat the system, I have no problem with them being debarred.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Raines. Thank you. Mr. Raines, you talked a little bit about inadvertent errors, and I'm wondering if I stepped out for a minute, so perhaps you gave an example of an inadvertent error, and if you could kind of walk through with me, and I think I heard you say that it's not necessarily the $10,000, it's not, they're going to pay that, it's not easy for them to pay necessarily, but as a business decision, they'll pay it. But it seems to me that the three-year disbarment, or the disbarment for this, would be a larger consequence. Could you just kind of run through what exactly that means from a business model or from a reputational perspective of what that might look like? Because I'm concerned about something that's inadvertent, and I see that there are many, many, many sections of statute that are listed that could be violated that I've had an opportunity to look through, and I'm just wondering if you can kind of just talk about that a little bit, about what that could mean.
Mr. Raines.
Absolutely. I think I have a better testifier to go to some of those ways people get tripped up over this. But you have situations, I can recall another episode where we've had some educational training funds that is used as a credit against a fringe. Part of the totality of prevailing wages, both the wage and fringe benefits that you pay for someone. We've had that repeatedly authorized under federal and state people. We had one public contracting authority that decided they didn't like it, that they'd set out a new standard for it. Basically the contractor looked at it and said, the authority looked at our member and said, Well, we don't have any statute to back it up. We don't have any rules to back it up. But if you don't like it, sue us. And he looked at it and he said, well, I have, you know, I'm going to spend at least $30,000 suing over this. And this is going to cost me $5,000 to $10,000 just to write the check. So I write the check. If he had not done that, he could have gotten debarred. He could have had $100,000 worth of payments held up by that authority. He would have actually had his reputation sullied by a debarment process. And frankly, he's one of my great contractors that pays $2 above the prevailing wage rate on the check as a matter of policy for him. He's not a cheap, low-rent guy. He's a guy who gold plates everything. And this is kind of the many things that come into it. Someone disallows a portion of your fringe that you've used all along the way, or you know, the bigger thing is when somebody comes in and says you've misclassified someone. This person that's a laborer for you went out and was carrying pipe for your plumbers, and he gets reclassified as a plumber on you. It can mean a major difference for you. You're doing things as you've always done them, and you come on and you have what's frankly a bizarre set of rules sometimes thrown on you that has nothing to do with how you normally do business.
Representative Pepin, and before you ask your next question, I'd like to get this. We got other testifiers, and I'd like to get this bill voted on by the top of the hour if we can, because we got another bill that's afterwards, and we got other bills we need to get done. But if you can make your answers a little shorter. Oh. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you'd consider more time. I actually have quite a few questions for the bill author as well, so I would just ask you to consider that. To get more context of this, I'm wondering if Mr. Raines could just talk a little bit about or help me understand, if you're the general contractor, how many subcontractors you might have that you would have to follow, that you have to, you know, make sure that you didn't, you know, break any of the rules.
Mr. Raines,
if you could give me a range.
Chair Nelson, Representative Pepin. It very much depends on the project. In some situations, the person taking the job is the prime contractor for themselves and has none. On something as large as the Viking Stadium, I don't know how many subcontractors they have on it, but it wouldn't surprise me if they were running into the multiple hundreds that are working on that job. There's lots of people out there, lots of coordination. I'd say on a typical, on a $5 million job, as always, it depends on what the job is. You could easily have 20 subcontractors on it.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Raines. That seems problematic to me.
Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Raines, I'm looking at this bill and trying to understand it more, but what would this bill do to the opportunity for different firms to compete or participate in bidding for a project? Would it increase the opportunity for business for those folks, or would it decrease their opportunity?
Mr. Raines.
I think definitionally it's going to decrease the opportunities. There's increased liabilities, and there's opportunities for people that they're doing their best to comply with the law that will look at the liability and either be debarred under it or look at it and say, I don't want to deal with it.
Representative Scouse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Raines. So, Mr. Raines, so if there's less opportunity and it seems to mean, or would seem to expect it to mean, that competition then would be decreased or increased under this bill compared to the status quo.
Mr. Raines.
Chair Nelson, Representative Droskowski, opportunities would be decreased. There would be fewer people bidding. I talked to a contractor last night who told me he has just sworn off public work because of the current difficulties that he has with it, and he can do private jobs easier and make more money and keep more people employed by doing private work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Raines. So we've got decreased opportunity for job for construction firms, decrease competition in the bidding process, it seems to me that that would mean that the costs of these projects would go up. Is that what your sense is, Mr. Raines?
Mr. Raines.
Chair Nelson, Representative Draskowski, yes.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Raines, so this is going to cost the projects some more, cost the government more. We're going to have to pay more money for these projects and extract more money from the taxpayers of Minnesota because of the policy in this bill. Mr. Chair, I would ask, I've got some more questions maybe for the author. Should I save those for later?
That would be great because get the other testifiers through and then that may spur more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions of Mr. Raines? Thank you. The next person I have on my list is Mark Becker. And I see Mr. Werke coming up with Mr. Becker. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape, who's ever going first, and then proceed with your testimony. And again, try and keep it concise.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is Tim Werke, and I represent the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. We're the largest construction association in the state, 450 members, principally union contractors and union signatory contractors. And I want to make a few perfunctory remarks, and you've heard a lot of concerns that have already been addressed with the bill, but I think it's important to say on the front end that our organization supports the direction or the tenet of a fair and competitive marketplace that I think that this bill is trying to get at. And our members absolutely support playing by the rules that are established and are delineated in the bill. We're a little concerned about the approach that the bill has taken for the reasons you've heard and maybe for a few more. My concern in general is that the advocates for this bill that have put it together in our partnership, the business model, if you will, for construction, the union model in this state, that we were not brought in on the front end of the development of this bill. In particular, the Fair Contracting Foundation is a joint labor management function, and I'm not sure if this provision came from that group, but I was unaware that this was part of that discussion or where it came from, and we're hopeful that as this bill moves through the process, we can make some corrections and changes in it that will be more acceptable to our members, because as the bill stands now, our general contractors, union general contractors, are not in support of many, if not all, of the aspects in the bill. Particularly, you heard about the administrative burden that we believe is part of the underlying parts of this bill. It's important to point out that over 80% of our union contractors in our organization employ fewer than 20 staff, and we're concerned about the fact that this may bring about some administrative provisions. We don't believe it's as simple as simply having to file a piece of paperwork. That there would be more to it than that. Secondly, we're concerned about the accountability provisions. You heard significant testimony about that, but a debarment standard is significant. It's not just the loss of the opportunity for work. It is potentially the loss of your company and the loss of the employment of those individuals and those jobs. Thirdly, the administrative and implementation aspects. There are a multitude, hundreds of public owners in the state that would be subject to this, and we're concerned about the fact that there may be multiple approaches across those public owners to how this could be administered, what the procedures are, what the rules are, et cetera, for that. So with those comments, in the interest of time, I'll stand for questions and let Mr. Becker address a few issues.
Mr. Becker, please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, I'm Mark Becker. I'm an attorney with the Fabianski, Westra, Hart & Thompson Law Firm. Our firm represents a lot of union contractors. Mr. Werke asked me to provide a few comments today on the bill. I won't repeat what he said, but I want to emphasize two points that I don't think have been made yet. One is there's a concern that we have about unintended consequences of this bill. It kind of goes hand in hand with what Mr. Werke said, with there being hundreds of municipalities and public bodies that would have the power to debar a contractor under this state or under this statute. And so, depending on how a particular public body would administer this rule, it could have unintended consequences. For example, if a contractor is working on many public projects in the state, they could have a problem on one project. Maybe it's a subcontractor that has an issue, or maybe it's an inadvertent issue. And then that public body would then debar that contractor for all other public projects that that contractor is currently working on, according to the statute. And so what you'd have is you could have a situation where a contractor has an inadvertent issue, and that basically would stop that contractor's practice and halt projects that are important to the Minnesota economy. And so I think that that is a potential and real unintended consequence of this particular statute that should be addressed. The other concern we have is about the due process rights for a contractor who's accused of a violation and may disagree with that. Oftentimes in legal disputes, there are two sides of the coin where parties disagree over whether there's a violation or not. And so for a public body to have the power to debar the contractor, basically give the contractor a death penalty, there should be some due process protections in the statute.
Questions of the testifiers? Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a Tom Revenue. Hope I said that correctly.
You did, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Tom Revenue. I'm with the law firm of Seton Peters and Revenue. And our firm represents both union and non-union contractors throughout the state of Minnesota. And oftentimes we work with our contracting clients on prevailing wage issues. And we believe that this bill is bad public policy. And let me give you an example. And this is a contractor that just faced a number of audits by both the federal and the state government. The first audit that they had took place, let's say it was approximately September of 2013. U.S. Department of Labor conducts a full audit, a clean audit from a wage and hour perspective. About a month later, the Minnesota Department of Transportation conducts an audit. And MnDOT conducts that audit, and they find that it's completely clean, no issues. Now, both the Department of Labor and MnDOT looked at whether or not this employer was paying appropriate wages based upon the fact that they had what is called a Davis-Bacon 401k plan. I'm not going to get into the substance of that, but in essence, both the federal agency and MnDOT said, you're doing this properly. Well, apparently somebody wasn't quite happy, so they had the Minnesota Department of Labor and industry get involved, and Dolly, when they conducted their audit, they decided that without even reaching out to the contractor, without even asking for documents, they submitted an order to comply to this contractor. Now, on the very nature of the bill as it's written right now, because Dolly issued an order to comply, that contractor would not be a qualified bidder on state projects. No due process there. Dolly just submitted an order ordering them to produce documents without even a phone call, without even a letter. An order was issued. In addition, I've had litigation with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And in that particular litigation, it was a case that went on for 9 years. The contractor entered a contract with MnDOT in 2000. And 9 years later, MnDOT and the contractor were arguing over the proper classification of work. And you heard Phil Raines discuss earlier with regard to whether or not an iron worker or a carpenter installs the hollow metal doors. But there are a variety of issues that came up in that particular case, including who installs sheet metal lockers, whether that's a sheet metal worker or it's a carpenter. And the list goes on and on and on. We believe that this bill is bad public policy. And if you take that case that went on for 9 years, this bill, if it is passed, will lead to more litigation because contractors who want to do business with the state are going to fight over each and every issue that the state raises. In essence, what happens is then the workers who allegedly weren't paid appropriately are going to be waiting longer and longer and longer to get paid because there's going to be a lot more litigation going on. So we believe that this bill, as it's written right now, is bad policy.
Thank you, Mr. Renault. And that's the last of my testifiers on my list. Questions for the testifiers or for the author? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions for the author, and I'm kind of trying to figure out how this, I guess, the timeline works. And if you look at the top of page 3 in the delete everything, there's a laundry list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, at least 7 different areas of statute that could potentially be violated and could set off this policy. And I don't know if you have a statute book in front of you, but there's a couple of them that troubled me. One was 181.13 and then 181.14, and I can just kind of tell you what they talk about. And 181.13 is penalty for failure to pay wages promptly. And it says it's basically they have to pay their wages within 24 hours after demand. And then 181.14 talks about employees who quit or resign, and also says they have to pay, I think, within a number of days or something after they demand payment. And it seems like there's some kind of tight timelines there. So I'm just kind of wondering if you could walk me through how it works. So if they were to violate and I said, oh, well, you didn't pay me within 24 hours, and then it looks like there could be a violation if they don't pay the penalty of $10,000. But could you kind of just walk me through the timeline of when the $10,000 kicks in and when the three-year violation and the debarment kicks in?
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I'd bring down Kyle Macario if he might address this better than I can.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and help us with the answer.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin, my name is Kyle Macarios. I work for the Carpenters Union. I understand, I mean, under the minimum requirements statute, and particularly number 2, there's a series of existing wage and hour laws. And so I think what the intent of this bill is to make sure that contractors who are being awarded taxpayer-funded projects are in compliance with a series of existing state laws, and you have correctly identified several of them. Existing state laws regarding properly paying your employees when they're terminated or when they quit or when they're working on public projects. The starting on 2.3 of the amendments. Nope, I'm looking at the bill. Of 3.5 of the amendment, we try to clarify to specifically address concerns that you've heard, which is that a minor violation or an inadvertent violation of the law would not trigger this requirement, right? Would not deem that a contractor is not responsible. They would only have to certify that they have not violated these laws and failed to pay their workers over $10,000. So the second part of that, for the purposes of this section, a violation of this section is only, a contractor wants to has to certify that they have not violated these laws to the tune of $10,000 or more.
Representative Pepin. And Representative Pepin, I think the 181.13 you were talking about has to deal with if a person gets laid off, that the employer, and it's not just contractors, but all employers in the state of Minnesota, if the employee asks for their wages immediately, that they have to, they got 24 hours to produce them, they can't hang on to them. I lay you off on hours that you've already worked, I can't hang on to those wages. I believe that's the statute you're quoting in 181.13. And Mr. Shepard could correct me if I'm wrong. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, actually it's on 181.14, it's payment to employees who quit or resign, settlement of disputes. So in my reading of that, that would mean that if I were to quit and I demanded that I had that payment right away, then that could potentially set off a violation. So I'm just trying to avoid inadvertent consequences, and it seems like there are a lot of, just looking at this laundry list, it seems like there's a lot of ways that there could be an inadvertent consequence, and the penalties are very severe. And so I'm just, I just have some concerns, and I'm trying to understand the exact, I guess, the timeline of when the, you know, the $10,000 and then the, when the three-year disbarment comes in, because when Mr. Raines testified, he seemed to feel that the four purposes of this clause created a whole new section and had a lot of concerns about that. So I'm just trying to understand the timeline, and I guess as long as if you could address that a little bit more. But I'm also kind of wondering how this relates to other states and kind of competitiveness, and do other states have such a detailed statute that in my mind, you know, could really have a lot of consequences if there was an inadvertent error.
Representative Sundin, Mr. Macarius.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative, would like to answer that. Wisconsin did enact a similar statute last year, and I simply can't report on success or failure of that at this point.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have a lot of questions, but I know you're trying to get through this bill. I guess I'll just ask the author. It seems like there's a long way from agreement on this bill, and that the contractors have a lot of concerns, and I'm just wondering if you're going to continue to work with those groups, or if you view this as pretty complete as to where you're at. And then also, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask for a roll call on this bill.
Roll call's been asked for. Roll call. Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think that's a great point. Prior to the hearing today, I met with some of the concerned parties here, and they've agreed to sit down and perfect this piece of legislation and address some of your concerns, and actually a couple more that weren't brought up today. So in the interest of time, we are working on it, and I urge support.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sundin, what's the objective of the bill? I mean, I think I understand at this point what it does, but what's the motivation for it? What do you hope to accomplish, fix, improve in terms of the lives of Minnesotans, the state budget, or other things?
Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this is to increase the standards to a little bit higher level, so all the employees of contractors are treated fairly and compensated properly. And now, as far as the benefit to the state of Minnesota, I think it can actually be quite profound. If you take a look at the billions of dollars that we spend on contractors and vendors every year, if we hold them to a higher standard and expect more, require them to act honestly in the construction industry, that's going to weed out the bad players that cause litigation, cause some of the problems in the construction industry. So if we clean up the playing field and make it fair for everybody, I think it's going to be a good return for the taxpayers of Minnesota.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Drazkowski, somebody whispered in my ear that your previous question came close to the line of questioning motives, but I know you weren't doing that.
Mr. Chair, I'm not questioning the motive of the author or any of his maneuvers, but questioning the motivation of the bill, and I would expect every bill's got a motivation behind it, whether it's a group or an objective. And so I think it was proper, but I hear you. You've got the gavel, Mr. Chair.
Well, somebody was whispering, Mayor. I don't believe it did, but just be cautious.
Thank you. So thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Sundin, we heard the testifiers say that this is going to decrease opportunity, is going to decrease competition, and it is going to increase the cost of these projects, which is going to cost the people of Minnesota more to do the same thing. Now, I would suspect or hope that's not an objective of the bill, but have you considered these outcomes?
Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yeah, that particular testifier offered up a lot of anecdotal instances where that could be the case, but I simply don't believe that, and I don't believe anyone else should.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Sundin, I looked at this is a very sweeping bill. I mean, it. I was adding these up. We've got 853 cities in Minnesota, 87 counties, 320 or 330 schools, 1,790 townships. We're over 3,000 different units of government that this bill impacts, and that doesn't include the Housing Redevelopment Authority, Port Authorities, Economic Development, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is very sweeping, and have you considered input from those units of government? Have you talked to them and gotten their feedback on the bill as you've developed it?
Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chairman, yes, Representative, we have been including them in the conversation, and we'll continue to do so when I take a look at some of these amendments that you haven't seen and that we'll be working on as this bill moves forward.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sundin. One last question. One of the testifiers mentioned the Fair Contracting Foundation, and I understand that they have, or it's been said that they have model types of legislation. Are you familiar with them, and is this a piece of model legislation from that organization?
Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not aware of anything like that. This is the first piece of legislation that I've introduced and that did not come from the Fair Contracting Foundation. They were kind enough to offer a lot of background information and establish a case for a need for this. That I think that's pretty much where their participation ended in this process.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sundin, I have several concerns being in the building and remodeling industry. Subdivision 5, line 412, is subcontractor verifications, and it says that you must include an accurate list of subcontractors and vendors to be used in the project. I know that being in the industry for 28 years, that our lists have gone down greatly. There's a lot of people who are no longer in the construction industry. And talking to, we do residential only, but I have several good friends who are in the commercial realm, and they're saying it's really hard to give an accurate list of subcontractors and vendors in this day and age because it has changed greatly. We do not have the people involved in the building industry like we did before. And he really felt that was limiting because sometimes you just don't know. It's really hard to provide that. And then I have an issue with Subdivision 6, 417, which is additional criteria. And when I read that, to me it almost means that you can have an unqualified person can pick who they want as a contractor. And I certainly am not in agreement with that. And overall, my feelings on this is that what we're doing is really limiting the playing field in a time where businesses is on the uptick very little. And it has changed greatly. And so I look at this as being very limited to a lot of the companies I know who are good, reputable people. I just don't see it as a plus to the industry right now. And I really think it needs a lot of work before we would even attempt to sign this into law.
Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for those two questions. Firstly, there's two contractor organizations that are represented, I believe, in excess of 700 or 800 contractors. You'd probably get a better answer as far as who's available for performing work in the state from those two people than I. And Mr. Makarios would like to respond to the second question.
Mr. Makarios.
Especially additional criteria, that subdivision, Mr. Chair and Representative Tice, specifically came from the League of Cities to ensure that we weren't doing anything in here to limit what I think many cities have is existing criteria in their own ordinances for letting contracts. So what we're trying to do with this bill is simply say here are some minimum criteria that we think people who are trying to be awarded taxpayer-funded projects should meet. These are minimum criteria that they follow a set of existing state laws. They sign up under oath that they can meet these criteria, submit it, but that we're not going to limit what any local control, what any city or county or school or township or any other entity has in terms of additional criteria. So we're not creating any additional criteria here. What we're trying to do is set some minimum criteria that would apply to all public contracts so that our taxpayer funds are not ending up in the pockets of contractors who are violating the law.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sundin, a while ago when Representative Raskowski asked you a question about what one of the witnesses said, you said, I don't believe that happened, and I don't believe anyone else should believe that either, or something to that effect. And I guess I'm wondering if you have some reason to believe that one of the witnesses was testifying dishonestly or not.
No, I just...
Representative Sundin.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. No, and Representative, that was my belief. I'm not attacking anybody as far as factual information. I think I referred to some of the testimony as anecdotal.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sundin, I just, you know, I've been around here a long time, and one of the things that I know is that for lobbyists, the only thing they have to go on is their reputation. And so I think we have to be very careful when we call out and we say that they're something that they're testifying on is inaccurate, because that can have a detrimental effect on their ability to influence legislation. And so I just ask you to be cautious when you accuse somebody of speaking dishonestly. I just ask that you be cautious of that in the future.
Representative Dorholz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Sundin, as you heard, there's several concerns brought up here today, which I too share. I'm just wondering if this bill is to move forward, if you could just be specific about some of those concerns you plan on addressing.
Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, I would. There's a couple of concerns that, as far as a contractor or vendor that's a responsible contractor at the time the contract is awarded remains a responsible contract for the duration of the contract. That means if we have a contractor that is discovered to be in bad standing as far as the criteria, he wouldn't be necessarily removed from that project that he might be performing on right at that time. So, and there's another one that amendment that's being offered up. We'll be discussing that kind of it's a little bit of a housekeeping thing that requires that would let me get this straight. Okay. If a contractor vendor that inadvertently allowed its license or bond to lapse, you know, as a responsible contractor, if that were to lapse or something, and if they took immediate action to remedy that, that wouldn't be a violation either. Those are some of the ideas that we're going to be looking at as this bill moves forward.
So, Representative Sundin, you're working with you're working with the opponents to try and make the bill better.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just pinging off of what Representative Dorholz and the testimony that was given by the bill's author. I would offer that we maybe lay this over or table it at least to the author's own testimony today. He said there are amendments that you haven't seen yet in language that's in there that they're working with folks, and we can't vote on a bill that has possible amendments out of this committee. And if those amendments are germane to what the scope of this committee is, we should at least be given the courtesy of seeing those to try to strengthen that. We may be able to get some more bipartisan support on this, but we are unable to vote on something that has, for lack of a better term, phantom amendments on it at this point. And to try to I would motion to lay it on the table, Mr. Chair.
There's been a motion made to lay it on the table. All in favor of that motion, that's non-debatable. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion fails. And Representative O'Driscoll, this has other committees and some other stuff that has been talked about is the purview of other committees, not just this committee. And it's the author has made his pledge to continue working on the bill as it goes forward to try and make it better. Representative O'Driscoll.
This will be my final follow-up on that. Again, there are things that we may or may not be, that may or may not affect this bill that this committee has jurisdiction on, and I would like to know what those areas are. And again, we have to vote on what's before us, not what the bill might look like as it proceeds to another committee. And from a good public policy standpoint, I'm disappointed that we weren't able to come to a more reasonable position on this today by laying it over.
Representative Winkler. Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative O'Driscoll's point, Mr. Chair, if an amendment comes forward in another committee that contains material that falls under the purview of this committee, are you prepared as a chair to pull this back into committee so this committee can review it properly?
We're talking in speculation, and I don't know what they are. Like I said, it's some of the stuff he's mentioned is stuff that's elsewhere. I'm not going to make a commitment to that one way or the other right now. We'll see. Representative Skowski. Any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 1984, as amended, be re-referred to the Commerce, Consumer Protection, Finance, and Policy Committees. All those in favor, say aye. A roll call has been requested.
Nelson?
Yes.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Pepin?
No.
Dorholt?
Yes.
Druskowski?
No.
Falk?
Yes.
Hansen?
Yes.
Kahn?
Yes.
Ween?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pew?
No.
Sanders?
Aye.
Tice?
No. Mm-hmm.
Winkler?
Yes.
Being nine, yes, and five, is that eight ayes and Representative Sanders, did you vote aye or?
Aye.
Okay, so there are nine ayes and, is that a five? Five nays, that's what I was, it looked like an S here. The bill is passed, or the bill is, then the bill will move to the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee. Thank you. The next bill on the agenda, if we can get it done in the next few minutes, is Representative Mullery's. And members, this bill is similar in scope to the bill that we just had. Representative Mullery, if you would welcome to the committee. And again, I'll move that House File 1943 be re-referred to the Commerce and Consumer Protection, Finance and Policy Committee. And Representative Mullery, again, as we said earlier in the committee, there's an amendment in your packet, but we're not going to put the amendment on because it did make our 24-hour rule. But again, it goes to the Consumer Protection and, my understanding, Labor Committee, Labor and Workplace and Regulated Industry Committee is going to be there also, so there's places for him to put those on. Does need to do a little. I'm wrong. It'll just go to Commerce from here and then Jobs. Representative Mullery, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair and members, I've been working on prevailing wage enforcement since 1998 at the request of, at that time, the head of the building trades in Minnesota, Ray Waldron. And actually, this is one of the things, I looked at my notes from way back then last summer, and this is one of the proposals that we were thinking of. And there's still just continuing violations on both that and on minority hiring and contracting and women minority contracting. And basically after all this time, decade and a half, I'm really tired of contractors who don't comply with the state's laws, and we do want to have, as a state, we should have fair treatment of contractors who are complying with our laws. And my bill applies to not just, the last bill applied to construction, this applies to all contracts because we have those laws for everybody in the state, not just construction contractors, and it should apply to everybody. My bill is not an automatic exclusion. If the agency feels it was a mistake or de minimis, they can just write it up as an explanation for awarding it. As I said, I've been trying to get contractors. I've met over and over with the agencies and contractors over the years to try and get these laws enforced, and it's about time that the state starts enforcing its laws. The state, and I agree totally with everything on the last bill, and that's mainly on the construction trades issue. This bill also gets into minority hiring and contracting and women and disabled contracting and hiring. In addition, the state has a past history, it's been proven, of discrimination against minorities and women. And this state also put in laws to make up for that. Both Democrats and Republicans have supported those in the past to get rid of the past discrimination. So we need to help women and minority businesses get built up, because they were not on an equal footing. There was discrimination against them, so that they can compete. And it's also important that our state allow all groups to compete on a fair, equal footing. So with that, I believe our first testifier is Barbara Batiste from Council on Economic Status of Women.
And Representative Mulry, she comes down. Representative Pep, and I've been told that I didn't see your hand was up, that you had something to say. Or
thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to request that we take up a different bill. I think this bill needs and deserves a lot more time than the committee time allotted today, but you've already started. I just wanted to give you my opinion on that. This bill is very similar to the last one.
Yeah, and Representative Pepin, if we don't get this done in the next, say by quarter two, we will recess, and this bill will be held over till the evening tomorrow night. We've got but we'll just take this bill back up at tomorrow evening, and when we come back, because we have a large agenda that's going to be coming forward, and I'm trying to hurry people, and I know we want to fully vet things, but we need to get stuff through the committees so that we can get the stuff through and get it vetted in other committees also. Ms. Batiste, welcome to our committee. Please state your name for
the tape. Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Barbara Batiste. I'm director of the Legislative Office on the Economic Status of Women. The Office on the Economic Status of Women is a nonpartisan joint House and Senate office whose statutory mandate is to research and report to the legislature on all issues relating to the economic status of women. Through its 38 years, OESW has also become a liaison between the legislature and the community on women's economic issues. The underlying purpose of OESW is something that we all share, and that's to achieve and protect the economic security of women. I'm new in this position, and I'll try to speak to you during the session individually or formally, as in this hearing, when a legislative proposal affects women's economic status. I asked to speak on House File 1943 because it addresses the gender pay gap. As you'll hear often this session, Minnesota women overall earn 80 cents for every $1 a white male earns. For women of color, the pay gap is greater. Minnesota's African American women earn 60 cents for every $1 white males earn, and women 56 cents. There are a number of causes of the gender pay gap. 5 to 7 cents or so, about a third of the 20-cent gap, is unexplained, and academics believe it's due to discrimination and perhaps some to women's poorer salary negotiation skills. Some of the gap is due to hours work or attachment to the labor force. Women tend to cut back on hours or leave the workforce completely to care for loved ones, whether it be a mother caring for her young children, or a baby boomer woman caring for aging parents or young children, or a baby boomer woman caring for aging parents or spouse. About 8 cents of the 20-cent gap, or 40%, is attributable to a woman's occupation. Women tend to cluster in female-dominated, often low-paid occupations, the service industry, retail, administrative, and the lower-paid healthcare jobs. Policy can address this occupation problem in a number of ways. One is for society to recognize the worth and necessity of these women's jobs, but that's of our larger conversation and task. A second way is to address the women's occupation factor in the pay gap. To address it, it's to encourage women to gain job skills in higher paid traditionally male occupations, like the trades, technology, finance. A third way to help women enter higher paid occupations is represented by House File 1943. This way is to encourage employers to recruit and hire qualified women in higher paid, traditionally male-dominated jobs. House File 1943 does this by putting companies that contract to do business with the state on notice that a history of noncompliance with their state-approved goals for recruiting and hiring women will be considered when they bid on future state contracts. House File 1943 provides an incentive for businesses to meet their state goals of recruiting and hiring women for male-dominated, higher-paying jobs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Batiste. Any questions for the testifier? If not, Mr. Bruce Corey is your next person on the list. Representative Mullery.
Well, I was going to have... No, go ahead. We'll go that way.
Okay.
The Bruce Corey.
Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House File 1943. I'm Bruce Corey, an economist. You know, for a long time, we were dealing with a situation of a budget deficit, and we had to call Eeyore out because there was gloom and doom and gnashing of teeth. Now we have a budget surplus, and we see everybody opening up and thinking about the possibilities. The same kind of attitude has been in the state when we looked at immigrants and minorities. We've been looked at as deficits. And I want to challenge the committee and the legislature to start looking at our communities as assets, and I'll give you the economic case for it. As consumers, there are $12 billion of buying power. This is bigger than the GDP of many countries. If we put all the minority firms together as a group, they'd be the ninth largest firm in Minnesota and probably the 15th largest employer, employing over 40,000 people. If you just take black children in the high schools of the Minneapolis and St. Paul, and if you look at their lifetime earnings, if they complete a graduate degree, a bachelor's degree, we have a portfolio of about $30 billion in lifetime earnings. And if we look at the state incidence, tax incidence studies, the state gets 11% rate of return on every worker in Minnesota, a household in Minnesota. So you have ample reasons to say, how could we take this economic asset and grow it? The state has not had a very strong record in growing these assets. If you look at the last disparity studies for the couple of decades, we've been utilizing less than 1% of minority-owned businesses. If you look at employment of people as of workers, minorities as workers, not only in the private sector, in the public sector, we find them in both the low-skilled as well as the high-skilled areas. They're playing very important role. And if you look at the state demographers' projections, there's going to be a serious demographic squeeze in Minnesota where we're going to rely on these workers and these young people coming out of the pipeline to be the future workers of Minnesota. So what House File 1943 says, can the state be used as a leverage to grow these communities as businesses, as workers? The state, if it spends $30 billion, would be larger than the GDP of many countries in the world. That much leverage the state has. Why can't the state use that leverage to make sure that companies have mentoring relationships, use these businesses as subcontractors, that companies hire these workers, that companies involve students as apprenticeships and internships in their system? If we do that, Minnesota will really be a globally competitive state, because we're going to be invest strongly in the future of our citizens. And that's why I support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Corey. Mr. Corey.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative,
the handout went around, the updated handout. Thank you. And next is Robert Woods, who is the Executive Director of the National Association of Minority Contractors.
Okay. Welcome to committee, Mr. Woods. Please state your name for the tape. I think you'll be the last testifier today, and this bill will be carried over and taken up at a later date.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Nelson. My name is Robert Woods. I am the senior consultant for the National Association of Minority Contractors. It's a very big privilege to be able to testify to you guys on behalf of my community. I'm a resident of North Minneapolis. I'm a married guy with three kids, a business owner and a homeowner, and I've lived in North Minneapolis for about 25 years. I support this House File 1943 because I believe that taking this action will act as a catalyst to spur economic growth for both women and minorities. Secondly, I believe that but for these types of actions, these types of legislature, nothing really would happen for us as minority contractors and minority people. I also believe, sort of deviating, that it is not all up to you as legislators to solve all of these issues, and that this legislation just goes about leveling the playing field, especially when it comes to best value contracting. Minnesota, and I'll be brief, Minnesota has the largest disparity between European Americans and people of color economically in this country. Most of the people of color, immigrants and people of color, African Americans and Native Americans, did not come and do not stay in Minnesota because of the large entitlements or handouts. They have matriculated, much as I have, to Minnesota because it is one of the top performing economies in this country. We have come here to open up businesses, to better ourselves, and to feed our families. Minnesota is failing people of color because mostly the legislations, even when you pass them, are not being enforced adequately. They're not being enforced adequately by government employees, nor are they being enforced adequately by any group. Reason being, I don't know. I really don't. However, let's use 2014 to not talk about past discrimination, past history, or guilt feelings for European Americans to help us. By leveling the playing field with these types of files and with other kinds of ideas that we have come up with to solve our own problems, you can do better and further eliminating this disparity than anything else. I believe that what is lacking is a cohesive plan of economic development for minorities and women for their growth. That is what is lacking, and this bill is again a catalyst for that. You can reach me through Mr. Mullery. We have figured out how to improve ourselves in this state and become productive citizens that will not only help ourselves but will also add to the Minnesota regional economy and produce growth in our economy. I believe that as responsible people, as responsible legislators, you have to hold us accountable for producing return on investment types of results, and that has not been done. And I'm here on behalf of Mr. Mullery to say we are willing to step up and take responsibility for our community.
Thank you, Mr.
If you pass the legislation that we need.
Thank you, Mr. Woods. And with that, this bill will get carried over into the evening of tomorrow night. And unfortunately, the room tomorrow night's room is be 300 North, so it'll be smaller. Tomorrow morning, we're going to meet in the basement. And members, my charge to you is be here on time. I know we had a session and getting over here, but we need to get We have a large agenda for this session. Unfortunately, a lot of the bills that are coming forward all have to come through government operations, so we need to be able to get our work done. Charge the members that have bills that don't filibuster your own bills by having multiple repetitive testifiers that we can get through. And Representative Pepin, you had your hand up.
Yes, Mr. Chair, since it will be tomorrow night, that would allow those of us who didn't have time to review this more time to look at the amendment. And so I think that if this is appropriate in this committee, we would be okay with dealing with the amendment tomorrow night as opposed to pushing it off in another committee
We'll take that up tomorrow when the bill comes up. It's posted on the website now, so we'll take that up. And with that, members, apologize, Representative Mullery, but the meeting's up, so the meeting is adjourned for today.